Okay, let's take a look at the very last two, or the very last three books. And I want to start out with this kind of a question, which might seem like a really strange way to start to you, but I don't think it is. So lay Ezra and Nehemiah aside just for a second, and then if you're with me on page 162, just think about the answer to this question with me for a second. We talk about the charismatic debate. We're talking about, you know, people who talk about miraculous things being done in church services and elsewhere, and a little bit more on the miraculous side of things these days, you know, about what God can do and what God actually does do right now. And when you think about the answer to this, what is the core issue at the heart of the charismatic debate? Normally, if we had a full class hour, I'd let you talk about this for a second. But let me focus a little bit and say, here's what I'm talking about. My suggestion is it's not theology. That is, someone who says, I'm more charismatic or less charismatic, I don't think very often it's because someone says, I've really done a serious study of the Bible, and here's what I think the answer is. I think the answer is we should be more charismatic and be looking for more miracles, or I think we should be less. It doesn't always, or often, I don't think, actually stem from theology first, though we would like to think that everybody gets their belief systems from the Bible and works up. I think this one is a little different. So if that's not the answer, if theology is not the answer for the core issue, anybody have an idea what it might be? Or at least in my mind, what it might be? John? Feelings, perhaps, although, you know, I don't want to be derogatory and say, you know, some people, you know, lead with their head and other people lead with their heart, something like that, but I understand what you're saying. Any other way to say it? Why do people take different positions on this topic? Experiences and what people before you have believed, or what people in positions of authority or influence believe, that certainly would be true too. Let me just cut right to the chase here and tell you what I think. Just going to do it anyway. My guess is it's a desire to feel or to experience God. To be assured that He exists and is active in my life. And you have to write this stuff down word for word. This isn't, you know, the essence of Ezra and Nehemiah, but it kind of gets at the issue, because I think there are an awful lot of people who say, I just want to experience God. I don't want to just live in sort of a Christian naturalistic life where I pray, but I don't ever see any answers to prayer, or I want to know God, but I don't have any, you know, in a good way, existential evidence or existential, you know, sense that God is here. And I would even go on to ask the next question and say, is this desire wrong? Some people would say, well, it's not living by faith. You got to live by faith, you know, and make faith a very just head thing, very cognitive thing. And I guess I'd ask this next question: do you want to be assured that God is actively working in your life? And I don't know about you, but I'd kind of like to know that God is actively working in my life, wouldn't you? I mean, how many people here have not said, maybe you haven't said this, but I often have thought, you know, God, it sure would be nice if you would just break into life here and do a couple of really amazing things. You know, it's really nice to read about all the miracles, you know, in the New Testament, about people being raised from the dead. And I'm sure that in Ezra and Nehemiah's day, it was really nice to look back and think about the Red Seas and the plagues and those kind of things. And you know, even in Daniel's time, where the people are exiled to Babylon, and people say, wouldn't it be nice if God would demonstrate Himself really powerful, like shut some lions' mouths, or have some people thrown into a furnace and come back out alive, and man, it would really be nice if God would do some of those things today. I don't know about you, but I felt that way. God, I don't have to see a lot, but just one little miracle, man, that would really, really be nice. I just want to be assured that You're working in my life and my world today. And I think that's an awful lot of what these people were feeling like back here. The situation, the occasion in Ezra and Nehemiah is very, very similar. They're still reading things in the Old Testament about God's miraculous work, and yet they're looking around at their life and where it is today, and the kind of things they're saying are things like this: the light's on, but nobody's home. You know, we talked about this before. The lights are on at the temple, but God's not living there. Does He really care? And they can say it this way too. Our relationship with God, as defined by Deuteronomy, is pretty well over. Because the ultimate curse of the law, Deuteronomy 28, has come upon us. The old covenant is gone. And exactly what is our relationship with God now? Hard to define. The old covenant relationship is broken, but the new covenant relationship isn't here yet. So what is our relationship with God? And is it real? Is it functional? Does God care? Is he active and working in the life of the nation? And I think it's a legitimate question to ask. And so there is an answer to it. And the answer, of course, comes with Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra and Nehemiah are going to try to answer this question. Does God still care? Is he still working in our life? And they're going to do it like this. Ezra and Nehemiah answer the question by recounting the stories of rebuilding. Two things. They're going to tell the stories of rebuilding two things. You know what they are? The wall and the temple, or to put it chronologically, the temple and the walls. Right? In Ezra, we get the temple rebuilt. In Nehemiah, we see the walls rebuilt. But we don't just tell these stories about the buildings being rebuilt. We tell it with special emphasis upon the providential actions of God. God is at work. God made this happen. It wasn't just a group of people who were highly organized with great leadership who got together and pulled together and said, man, look at that. It was really, man, you know, God made this thing happen. So, I want to talk about both of those lines up there, the temple and with special emphasis. Let's talk about the top one first of all, okay? By recounting the stories of rebuilding the temple and the walls. Now, as you take a look at the chart you've got there at the bottom of the page, the way we can kind of cover this is this way. With Ezra, those first six chapters are about the rebuilding of the temple. And the latter chapters are about his rebuilding of the people. Same thing with Nehemiah. Nehemiah starts out the first several chapters talking about how God rebuilt the walls, and then at the end, it's about God rebuilding the people. Now, let me see if I can explain that, you know, methodology to you, okay? What he's going to do is he's going to tell these stories about how the temple was rebuilt. And with Ezra, of course, it's kind of ancient history because Ezra is living down here in the place where chapters 7 to 10 are. And so he's telling a history that's 60 years old or 80 years old. And what he's going to do is look back and say, you know, when that temple got rebuilt, it was an amazing work of God. God clearly made it happen, and God is at work among the people today. Now, it might sound like a pretty lame story, but let me put it this way. Dr. Dixon always had an amazing knack for doing this kind of stuff. He could always tell the story of Cedarville better than anyone. And I loved when he would tell stories about the ministry center and the chapel over there now. Because years ago, when I first came, we didn't have that place. And we used to get together where Apple is and only held 2,000 people. And at that point in time, we were already like 2,400 people. So we couldn't get together in one place for chapel. So you'd have these like satellite chapel areas. We'd go over to ENS 245, and you had the video there, you know. And someone would get up to sing, and they'd do a special music. And then afterwards, you'd clap, and you'd think, gee, why am I clapping here? You know, like, nobody hears this. And the whole thing was really pretty lame. And it was spread out a lot of places. And so Dr. Dixon said, listen, we want to put our money where our mouth is. And what our mouth is that chapel is the heartbeat of Christian College. So how can we do this? Well, everybody knows, every businessman knows that one of the worst possible investments you can make is in a building that's used 1 hour a day. And that's exactly what a chapel is. It's a horrible, horrible investment. It cost $15 million. And so he said, you know what? It's a really bad investment, as most people would think, but it's part of our mission. It's what we do. And so what we're going to do is we're going to try and build it. And they really stepped out on faith, and they set aside like $500,000 just to pay the interest on the loans they'd have to take out. And by the time the thing was finished, all the money was in. They didn't have to spend any of the money to take out loans at all. It was just clearly a God thing. And he tells the story a whole lot better than I do. But when he tells that story about how that place was built, you say, man, we put our money where our mouth was because we really feel like chapel is important and central to what we do. And God made it happen. When he finishes that story, you say, man, I want to be a part of this place. And that's exactly what Ezra is trying to do here and say, listen, God made that temple work, so let's get our own hearts together. Temple and then the people. So when he's talking about rebuilding the people, he's talking about revival in the people. Right? And that's the rationale. The same thing happens here in Nehemiah. Nehemiah says, you know, when those walls got rebuilt, there was a lot of opposition. It never should have happened. Anywhere else it wouldn't have happened, but God made it work. And don't you know, that's a clear testimony that God is at work among us. Therefore, let's get our own hearts together. And so he kind of rebuilds the people at the end of that too. Okay, so both of them have the same kind of rationale. Let me talk to you about the second part. That is this. With special emphasis upon the providential actions of God. Now, this is what make Ezra and Nehemiah so different than stories like Daniel or the others with miracles involved, okay? Because the difference between miracles and providence is this. Miracles are when God breaks the laws of nature. We're pretty used to those, okay? Sometimes we use the word miracle in a real sloppy way, but a true blue, capital M, real live miracle is when you break the laws of nature. Like when you walk on water, when you raise dead people up, right, to life again. When you turn water into wine. Those are real kinds of miracles. Providence is when God is at work behind the scenes, manipulating events, but which the unbeliever would probably not recognize as from him. Now, is there a place, is that written out for you almost? Yeah, it is on page 163. That'll take a second just to do that. And then give you an illustration. Okay. So if we're going to be, you know, accurate here and distinguish between miracles and providence, let's look at Scripture. And we've already talked about some miracles. Let's talk about providence. When God is at work, and in both of these, God is at work, right? But give me an example of providence.
Esther.
Oh, good. I'm glad somebody came up with Esther, yeah. I was afraid somebody might forget it. What else?
The way Mordecai just happened to hear the guards talking about how...
Right. There's multiple examples in Esther, right? What else besides Esther? What other examples of providence can you find? Daniel? Like when? Like when?
Brothers meant it for evil, but God meant it for good.
Oh, yeah. Like Joseph. Good. No, there's good character in both those guys. Yeah, right. Good point. New Testament. Give me some New Testament examples of providence. Jesus being born in Bethlehem. God just happened to work it out through Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed and moves heaven and earth and people move around just so for one benefit that this one pregnant lady can ride a donkey down and have a baby boy born in the right spot, right? So God clearly is at work, but it's not breaking laws of nature, okay? So let me give you a modern day example just to make sure you get it here, okay? You are driving home after your last final exam, and you're going north on 72, or let's just say that for example, okay? And you are following the speed limits because you know you should, and because you don't want to die, and because you know that the county sheriff picks people up for going over 55 on 72. Okay, don't ask me how I know, but I'm pretty sure that's the case. So you're leaving here, okay, and you're going north, you're going pretty fast, and at the last second, you're up by the Ohio Air National Guard base, and this semi pulls out in front of you and completely blocks the road, nearly. And you're full with a radio, and you don't see it till the very last second. You look up, you just see it, and you think, oh no, and you swerve, and you just barely get around the thing. You don't know how you get around. You get back on track, and you get under control, and you're saying, oh, that was a miracle, right? Well, technically, it wasn't a miracle, right? It was providence. God allowed you to see the truck just nick of time, but you didn't really break any laws of nature. So yeah, God is involved, but it's providential. If you want it to be a miracle, then you have to rewind the story, and it looks something like this. You're driving down the road at 55 or 155 or whatever it is. Truck pulls out in front of you. Car levitates up 50 feet in the air, goes over the truck, and back down. And on your way, now that's a miracle, okay? And God could do that too, just as easily as he does the other thing. But in one place, God's kind of showing off. In the other place, he's not. In one place, God is breaking the laws of nature, and he's not. Now, in our day, God seems to have chosen not to be breaking laws of nature. At other times, he does do miracles, but other times, he uses providence. And what you're going to see here in Ezra and Nehemiah is God working behind the scenes powerfully, but it's behind the scenes, and unbelievers might not even notice he's working, but to his people, you can see it's the hand of God. All right? So, as you move through these stories, let me just show you a number of verses where I see this kind of thing emphasized, and it makes me think this is the big idea the authors are trying to show. For example, in the very first verse, like where we often see captions. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation. Now, miraculous or providential? Clearly providential, right? God's working in the guy's heart. He makes a choice. Kings make choices all the time. But what he's trying to say to us is God worked in his heart to make this choice for the good of his people. Everyone whose heart God had moved prepared to go up and build the house of the Lord. So again, it's kind of an internal thing. Nobody else knows about it, but God is the one who's working in the heart of the king and working in the heart of the people to make this job get done. This is just a verse to tell us about the actual work that's going on, which is Joshua and Zerubbabel building the altar and building the temple. But the eye of their God was watching over the elders of the Jews, and they were not stopped. Darius writes, "May God, who has caused his name to dwell there, overthrow anyone who attempts to destroy this temple." All of these things, just providential statements of God's care. For 7 days they celebrated with the joy of the feast because the Lord had filled them with joy by, look at this, changing the attitude of the king of Assyria. Again, behind the scenes, providential work. The king granted him everything he asked for the hand of the Lord his God was on him. And all of these stories, all of these verses just amount to the same thing. Praise be to the Lord, the God of our fathers, who has put it into the king's heart to bring honor. Because the hand of the Lord, my God, was on me, I took courage, because the gracious hand of our God was upon us. No miracles here, but lots and lots of providence that works. Now, that's the basic message of Ezra. God is at work to rebuild the temple. So let's get our hearts in line with his. The gracious hand of our God is on everyone who looks to him. Nehemiah is the very same message with one small addition. There's one more emphasis in Nehemiah that's not there in Ezra. Anybody who hasn't looked online know what the answer is? Return to the law. Ooh, that would be a good answer, because there is a lot of that in this book. But it wasn't the one I was thinking of. Nice try. Chris?
They had to actually fight after they had started going.
Yeah, they did. They did have to fight some opposition. There's a little bit more military kind of focus here. What I was thinking about, though, is this. That is, there's an emphasis upon prayer. Not only does God work behind the scenes, but he works behind the scenes in response to the people's prayer. So in this book of Nehemiah, a lot more about, hey, we prayed about it and God responded providentially. We prayed about it, God responded providentially. We prayed about it, God responded providentially. I prayed to the God of heaven, because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my requests. I answered them by saying, the God of heaven will give us success, we his servants will start rebuilding. So, here in Nehemiah, big emphasis. We prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. When our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to his own work. They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak and it will not be completed. But I prayed, now strengthen our hands. So through this whole thing, it's clear that God is working with them as an answer to their prayers. So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. All armies heard about this. All the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized this work had been done with the help of our God. So there are other lessons and a lot more we could talk about it in that Nehemiah, but I think that finishes the big idea I wanted you to know. Here we go. Malachi, the only Italian prophet. Everything else, every other prophet comes from Israel, but this guy came from Rome. His name means my father makes pizza. Not quite. He does have an important name, though. And you kind of see it right here. Malachi really is the very last word before Messiah comes. After this, we talk about the 400 silent years. It's silent, not because God isn't doing anything behind the scenes, but because God isn't actively proclaiming truth through a prophet. So Malachi is the last prophet here. And one of the things he does is to help get us ready for Messiah, among other things. And Malachi 3:1 is one of the best verses. It says, "See, I will send my messenger who will prepare the way before me. Then suddenly the Lord you're seeking will come to his temple, the messenger of the covenant." Now, there are two separate messengers I want you to see here. And two separate things I want you to know about. First thing is, to say, "I will send my messenger," in Hebrew, is a real punny thing to do. Because the way you say, "my messenger" is, take a wild guess, Malachi, exactly. "I will send Malachi." It's not really Malachi. He's going to send my messenger. So there is a messenger who's going to prepare the way before me, and then you're going to see somebody else, the Lord you're seeking. So see, there are two people here. The guy who gets things ready for the Lord, and then the Lord you are seeking will come to his temple, who is then called the messenger of the covenant. So there is my messenger, the forerunner, and then the messenger of the covenant, who is God himself, who is going to come to his temple. And when he does, here's what he's going to do. "He will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. He will purify the Levites and refine them like gold and silver. Then the Lord will have men who will bring offerings in righteousness." Now, as you think about it, this is really a pretty interesting statement. Because it says when Messiah comes, he's going to do something. What's he going to do? What's one of the very first things Messiah is going to do, according to this, when he comes? He's going to come to his temple and do what to it? Purify it. Right? We don't usually use that phrase, purify it, in terms of the life of Jesus. What do we say? Jesus came to the temple and cleansed it. Yeah, and he does that twice in his ministry. He does it at the very beginning of his ministry. It's one of the very first things he does in John chapter 2. And he does it during the very last week of his ministry, what we call the Passion Week, right after the triumphal entry. So it almost bookends his ministry. The first thing he does is come and purify the temple, and one of the last things he does is come and purify the temple. And so people who are watching and notice what he's doing when he walks up to the temple and runs out the money changers and the people who were in charge, and the money changers really were working for the Sadducees, people who were in charge of the temple, they say, "Whoa, look at what this guy's doing. This is a pretty amazing claim to in fact be a Messiah. And then there's another statement here at the very end of the book. The last two verses, Malachi chapter 4. "See, I will send you the prophet Elijah before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children, the hearts of the children to their fathers," where revival starts, "or else I will come and strike the land with a curse." Now, that's the last two words, two verses of Malachi of the Old Testament. Do you know where this prophecy gets picked up in the New Testament? Who are we talking about here?
John the Baptist.
Yeah, kind of. John the Baptist. In Luke 1:17, it says, talking about John the Baptizer, "And he will go on before the Lord in the spirit and power of Elijah," and then notice the phrase, "to turn the hearts of the fathers to their children, and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord." So it makes it look here as though that forerunner, that messenger who's coming to get things ready for Messiah, as described in Malachi, is fulfilled by John the Baptizer. Right? He is the guy who's coming and doing this Elijah-like ministry to prepare the way for the Lord. Now, that's the original statement. The trouble is, as you move throughout the New Testament, it gets even more complicated. Watch what happens. Matthew chapter 17 is what we call the Mount of Transfiguration. And Jesus is up on top of the mountain, and he is transfigured. That is, Peter and James and John get to see what he will look like in his glory when he comes back. And while he's up there, it says, "His face shone like the sun, his clothes became as white as the light. Just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus." Moses, the guy who obviously writes the law, and Elijah, the greatest of the prophets. So you got the law and the prophets, right? Kind of testifying to who Jesus is, just in case Peter, James, and John don't get it because he turns white like, you know, lightning, or as Mark says, his clothes were whiter than any launderer could whiten them. Just in case they don't get it from that clear, visible image, we got Moses and Elijah saying, yeah, this is the one whom we've been talking about, right? So, I mean, must have been a pretty exciting experience. Gets them to thinking theologically, I guess it would. And on their way down the mountain, they have this question for Jesus about Elijah. Disciples ask him, why then do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? And look at Jesus' answer. It's really curious. To be sure, Elijah comes and will restore all things. Now what verb tense is that? Future, right? But then he goes on and says this, but I tell you, verse 12, Elijah has already come. The verb tense, of course, is, you know, at least past. And they did not recognize him, but have done to him everything they wished. So who are we talking about there? John the Baptizer, right? They cut his head off, right? They've already done this to him. So it says, in the same way, the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands. Now, this is kind of interesting. So Elijah has to come before Messiah does, because Malachi has told us that. Right, Jesus? Is that the case? And he says, yeah, that's true. But I also want you to know, Elijah came in the past, but he's also come in the future. He's what? Yeah, both of those are true. You see, I think if the people had accepted him, had accepted John the Baptizer's message and accepted Jesus, then things would have worked out really well. But because the people rejected John the Baptizer and rejected Jesus, then there has to be a second coming. And in the same way there's a second coming of Messiah, there's going to be a second coming of a forerunner. That's why he says he already came once, but now he's going to come again. Brian?
Is that why the Jews rejected it? Because they're waiting for Elijah before Messiah?
Perhaps they were waiting for Elijah. You know, they always say that even on the cross. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. Is he calling for Elijah? You know? But clearly, when John the Baptizer is born, the prophecy is he's going to be an Elijah kind of a person, right, who prepares the way. So I don't know if you could say that was exactly the reason. I think it was their own sinfulness, but perhaps some use that. I don't know. So in the same way, we've got two comings of Jesus. Now we've got two comings of a forerunner. So if, in fact, there is an Elijah who still has to come, can you take some guesses about where that will be? Where in the rest of the New Testament do you see an Elijah kind of a person coming along? Not so much John. Paul? Oh, you mean the person of Paul? Maybe, except that Jesus doesn't come after him. Yeah, maybe if you go forward to Revelation chapter 11, look at this. I'll give power to my two witnesses, and they'll prophesy for 1260 days, which is how many years? 3.5 years, right? 3.5 years, clothed in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees, two lampstands that stand before the Lord of the earth, kind of a reference to Zechariah. If anyone tries to harm them, fire comes from their mouths and devours their enemies. This is how anyone who wants to harm them must die. These men have power to shut the sky, so it will not rain during the time they are prophesying. And you say, I see some parallels here. Because it was Elijah who brought down fire from heaven a couple times in 2 Kings chapter 1. It was Elijah who helped shut up the sky so it didn't rain for 3.5 years. So it looks to me like one of these witnesses is going to finally do the preparing of the way for the coming of Messiah that John the Baptizer wanted to do and did do, but people didn't accept, and so it's going to happen again. So this prophecy at the end of Malachi has some foreshadowing and ultimate fulfillment all the way out through the rest of the New Testament, not at the beginning, but at the end of the New Testament as well. And I think that's all I want to tell you about the messenger who's going to come. And then let's finish with this. You know, we've got who for Genesis 3, Genesis 12, Genesis 49, and 2 Samuel 7. With Micah, we've got Micah 5:2, the reference to what? To where he's going to be born. Daniel chapter 9, answering the question, when? And now Malachi 3 and 4, answering, I would say, you know, especially the part where it says he's going to come to his temple and going to cleanse it, I guess I'd just say, what is he going to do? So as you look at all these prophecies, you know, it's not much doubt about where he's going to come from, or whose lineage is, or when he will come, or what he will do. And so when Jesus shows up at the triumphal entry, and Jesus shows up and cleanses the temple at that particular time, there's really hardly any way you can miss knowing who this is. So the Old Testament is pretty clear about the problem and the solution, and about who it is who's going to come and make things right. Now, let me give you some real easy, free ones. Let me talk to you about some questions I want to put on the celebration on Wednesday that I think everybody should get 100% on, but let's just make sure. All right? So here we go. This is new. Nothing in your notes about this. Just have to put it in. If I were to ask you about some dates, would you know the dates that correspond with the deportation of Judah or the destruction of Jerusalem, which is the same thing? It's a very, very simple date. I've only said it about 3 million times. 586. Uh-huh. So that's easy. What about the deportation of Israel, the 10 northern tribes? That's easy too. That is, yeah, that's 722. Two southern tribes, 586. 10 northern tribes, 722. What about the division of the kingdom? Now, we didn't talk a lot about this. So this one you probably won't have off the top of your head, but I'll let you know now. So this is when Solomon dies. No, not 14. We talked about it just a little bit with Ecclesiastes. Now, this one, the answer to this one is 930. Okay? Whole kingdom is divided, 930. All right? Now, the next one you will know, I hope. The Exodus. What's the date of the Exodus from Egypt? Talked about it almost the first day. Yeah, this one is 1446. Okay? Just so you know some basic dates of chronology. All right, everybody good here so far? All right. Abraham, general date, real general date, 2000 BC. There's no reason not to get five answers absolutely right without even thinking about it. You want some more?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, that's pretty good, isn't it? Some references. Now, these should be pretty easy, too. If I ask you, where is the Abrahamic covenant, you can easily say Genesis chapter 12. Sure. If I ask you about the Davidic covenant, this is going to be a little harder, but again, you should have seen it six or seven times by now. What's that one? Did you get it, Molly? No? Sorry, you know what it is? No, that's not right either. Thanks, Sebastian. 2 Samuel chapter 7. We've used it in the chart several times. 2 Samuel chapter 7. If we talked about the new covenant, where is that one coming? Jeremiah 31. Mm-hmm. Jeremiah 31, 31 to 34. Oh, you don't have to know the verses, just the chapters. Good. Okay. Abrahamic covenant, Genesis 12, Davidic covenant, 2 Samuel 7, new covenant, Jeremiah chapter 31.